You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're Jim and Bobby Bell, your hosts for tonight.
And we're delighted to have you back with us again this week. Our opening music was Hot Texas by the Hot Texas Swing Band. We thank them for allowing us to open and close the show every week with that wonderful music. Hey, Jim. Where are we going to be live in the Los Angeles area April 22nd and 23rd of this year?
Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival. You know, this is an event that's been idle for 3 years because of COVID. Now it's coming back with a roar. It's just kind of got together in the last few months, so we're bringing all the details together. But we host the Buckaroo Bookshop, which we've been doing since 2009. We'll have right on the main street in Old Town Newhall. We'll have 13 authors under the tent discussing their books, showing the books, selling the books, and also giving some presentations at the library at the other end of the street. And there's a lot else going on too, right?
Yeah, there's cowboy country folk and bluegrass music across three stages. There's Western swing and country line dancing, trick ropers, and lots of visitors come out just for the peach cobbler, which is returning again this year. So I will be posting shortly on our Rendezvous with a Writer Out West Facebook page. Information about the authors that'll be with us and the hours of the public programming up at the Old Town Newhall Library. It's free admission, and it's just a really, really great time. So come out and see us April 22nd and 23rd in Old Town Newhall. And let's see. Oh, who's our guest tonight?
We have a special guest tonight. Randy Samuelson Brown.
And here she is.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome back. You've been with us before.
Thank you very much.
Yes, the last time Randy was with us in August, we talked about Brand Chaser. And we can't wait for the next one of this. When's that coming?
It's already come out, actually.
Oh.
Everything started coming really fast. So it's called Branded Graves, and it's the second one in the series.
Okay, well, we have to schedule you back again, Randy.
Of course. I'd love to come back.
And the one we're talking about tonight, Jim is holding it close to the vest over here. We are talking about, what are we talking about tonight?
On the Fringes.
Yes, and I'm trying to get that fabulous cover in the camera.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Okay, do you want to tell us a little about Randy?
We have just a little short bio here for our listeners out there. Randy's roots grow deep in Colorado. Born in Denver, she grew up in Golden and returned to Denver as an adult. She has a BA in history with a stint in postgraduate research at Trinity College at the University of Dublin. One of her favorite pastimes is exploring old Colorado towns, mining camps, assorted other historical sites, and riding horses. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you very much.
So this cover is really amazing. I'm going to try to get it even closer. So how did this cover come to be?
Honestly, I don't really know. So the book got published. They sent it to the artist. I will say this is published with Wolfpack. they do have a very good art department, and this is what came back. There is a skull in the story that has a major role, as much of a role as a skull could have, and they really picked up on that, and I think it's a beautiful cover. I was a little bit surprised. I thought probably they would do something more with a clairvoyant, like a woman with a scarf or a crystal ball, but nope. I got dark forest and a skull, so this is pretty awesome. I love it.
No, it's a great cover. A lot of times those covers, you think, how did that happen?
Yeah.
But this one, I know it sort of is that way too, but it happened very nicely.
And to the readers out there, I would say if you pick up a book because of the cover, you will not be disappointed.
Thank you.
So you were with us last August. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself and then what's kind of been going on since we last chatted with you?
Gosh. August seems almost like a lifetime ago, and it's only a few months, so I don't really know. Let's see, Branded Graves came out, so that's great, and On the Fringes came out, and I'm working on the third installment of the Dark Range series, and I'm also working on a history of the Western American horse. I'm going to... different types of horses, different styles of riding. How do they come out to the West? What are Mustangs? What are Cayuse? Indian horses, different saddles and tack that's changed over the years. So horse thieves, of course, because I always have to do the dark side of everything. So, So I was talking to the BLM today up in Northwest Colorado about the wild horses. And, it's all good. Been riding a lot, writing.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
You're a busy gal. Lots of research on that one. That's all nonfiction. That's nonfiction.
Yeah. It's nonfiction. And, it's just kind of interesting. I think the Western horse is it's such a huge symbol of Western America, and there aren't that many books about it, about their contribution. It's amazing. It's really amazing. They're amazing animals.
Well, I'm sure that's going to have a very wide reading audience. I just have to believe you got a winner there. Yeah.
Yep. I think so.
Do you want to go ahead and ask her about your first question about On the Fringe? On the Fringes.
What's going on here in the book here? Who are the characters?
Well, we know it's set in an old West mining town.
Yep.
And it's cold and it's muddy. And yes. And we have a clairvoyant. We have a brothel madam and some other interesting characters. So how did this all get together?
Well, I have an earlier book called Market Street Madam, and when I was doing the research for that, there is a brothel museum in Cripple Creek, Colorado, called the Homestead House. And I was going through it, and I don't know why I looked over there, but on the wall there was a page of an old telephone book from the 1890s, and it was under glass, and I was just kind of looking at it, and it said clairvoyant and a phone number. And I thought that was fascinating. I'm like, I want to know who that clairvoyant was. So then it started, I started doing research through newspapers, and clairvoyants always came to gold camps. And they would make rather extravagant claims, like, I can tell you your name. You don't have to tell me anything. I'll give you your first and last name. I'll tell you how far to drill. I'll tell you where to drill. I'll tell you what you're going to, be pulling out of the ground. And I thought, wow, how is that actually possible? And I'd noticed they wouldn't stay in town really long, so they'd be there like 3 days and then they'd be going somewhere else. And so I thought, what if you really did have a real clairvoyant?
Right.
And what if she came west with the assumption that gold was just lying around? Because actually we all know today that it never was, but you could get rich, but she doesn't know that, and she decides she is going to sense ore deposits. So that is what the story's about.
Now, we don't want to do a lot of spoiler alerts, but it's pretty early in the book. She's on a train, and something happens to her on that train. What in the world? Tell us about Charlie Skiptown is what she called
Skiptown Charlie.
Skiptown Charlie. You know, when I started this book back, this is a book that took a few years to write. So this isn't like, you know, a fast cobbled together story. But, you know, it just struck me one day that bad marriages are nothing new. It's just that in the old days, like when women didn't always have jobs, I mean, a lot of people just stuck with the bad marriages. And she married a guy that her family, you know, basically warned her against, and they were right. And, you know, she was headstrong. She wanted to go west. She wanted to see something of the world. And this marriage kind of afforded her that opportunity. But she really picked the wrong person. So that's kind of what happens. And I guess it's not too big. Well, is it a, it might be a big spoiler to say what happens, but you know, she finds her footing, shall we say. And, you know, one interesting thought is you didn't have to continue west if something happened that you didn't want to happen. You could go back home. I mean, if you had enough train fare, I mean, it would cost the same going east or west. So you really have a decision to make as to what you wanted to do. And so, you know, just that thought that you could return to the East Coast. I mean, that just never occurred to me before, which sounds so ridiculous. But no, I had her keep going west, so she ended up in Cripple Creek because everybody was coming west.
The year I think is 1895 into 96 or 1896.
I think it is. It's before this labor strike. So.
Yeah, I was curious why you chose
95.
Yeah, why you chose to set it in that rather than say the 1870s or 1880s? Why you chose to set it then?
Gold was not discovered in Cripple Creek. This was our last big field that we found. It was found, they found it about 1893, 94, and they found it during earlier times, but it was all a hoax. It was totally a hoax. They're like, we found gold. All these people came in. There was nothing anywhere that they found. So finally, they do find it again, and it turned out to be our largest gold strike. And so I wanted to make sure that I stuck with when there really was gold coming out of the ground.
I know you have questions.
She meets, well, she's befriended by, at first, by one of the, as we call them in the book, dollies.
One of the dollies. Yep.
Yeah. But she meets, of course, the madam, but she also meets Rose, who runs the fortune teller emporium, who is a fortune teller. Now, can you kind of, is there a real difference sort of between a fortune teller and a clairvoyant? We can see in the book that there appears to be, but.
So Rose in the book, you know, are you going to give a person a real fortune that you can honestly see, that you can read in the cards, that you can tell what's coming down the pike for you? Or are you in it for a business where you can just fool people and tell them things and they pay you and that's how you make your bills? That's kind of the two differences that we have. And actually, one of my favorite scenes in the book is when Maud, who is a genuine clairvoyant, and can read cards, you know, and she can read palms, meets Rose, and she realizes, you know, the woman is like giving her a job interview, and she realizes during the course of her job interview that Rose really can't do what she does at all. And Rose recognizes it too, and she doesn't take it poorly. She's just like, oh, ho, ho, we're going to make money here. You know, and I just think it's just, you know, it's these characters sometimes really do come alive, you know, and it's just like she just strikes me as like a batty great aunt that you have, you know, with a bunch of cats and the Spanish shawls and all this stuff kind of going around. you know, and she acts the part. She's got the premise. She's got the business. She just doesn't have the skill set that really backs it all up in an honest way until Maude kind of stumbles across her path. So, yeah.
Yeah. They're interesting, two women together. Yeah, their scenes are interesting together. Their dialogue and all between Rose and Maude is really fun reading. And then the skull that's on the cover, do you want to talk a little bit about that skull?
Sure. So the skull is for Rose, the woman who owns the Fortune Emporium, is nothing more than a prop. Apparently she gave some miner a sham fortune. The miner actually couldn't pay because she didn't know to get the money up front. And he's like, well, I have the skull. So he gives her a skull. Okay. She accepted it as payment. Maude, actually, when she sees the skull and touches the skull, she gets energy off of it, which once again, Rose doesn't. And then Maude starts getting kind of, she calls him Charlie because that's what Rose calls her, which is actually her Skip Town Charlie. So it's a kind of a coincidental that they both have the same name. But, you know, at this point in time, it's almost like Maude's only friend in town is the skull named Charlie, you know, that she can get currents off of. And basically an assorted character, an assorted set of oddball characters that you find in gold camps, you know, so it's kind of interesting. And then Maude really does start to worry who was Charlie in real life to a degree, because she honestly thinks it's an Indian skull. And, yes, you know, she's like, well, you know, you shouldn't really have that just sitting around. And Rose is like, well, he don't eat much, you know, and that wasn't really the point.
Would you like to read something out of the book, Randy?
Sure. I am reading out of chapter 8. It's called A Wide Open Town. And so let me read you a little bit. Late October, 1895. The landscape's sheer blastedness caught Maude off guard. Hacked off stumps were all about that remained of trees, dotted and scattered about. Discarded mining entrails spilled down the mountainsides, those same slopes crisscrossed by roads meant for hauling. The ground vibrated underfoot while industry echoed, a strange symphony almost musical, but maybe that was pushing things a bit too far. Rooted on the platform and eyes still scanning the hills, a man tipped his hat in passing, about to offer a pleasantry until he took in the bruising on her neck and thought better of it. Shaking off the insult, she bumped alongside the other passengers down the incline toward the center of Cripple Creek's business district. Jangling music of another kind leaked out from saloon stacked upon saloon, the occasional grocer or dry goods horning in for good measure, respectable and upright. But she wasn't fooled. So that's her initial impressions of Cripple Creek, which was one of our mining towns.
And we're holding up the cover again. Oh, did you want to say? Oh, Jim has something to say.
It's a pretty big town at that time. Yeah, it's bigger than the story. And it seems like the men had control of everything in town. And if you were a lady, you were kind of on the short end of the stick in most situations.
Yes, you, on the surface of it, I would say you were right. I just, I always kind of think talent, desperation, perseverance sometimes wins out no matter what sex you are and no matter what year it is.
And Maude's a very tough character, and she's really a likable character at the same time. And she actually, there's a scary thing she goes through with no money is the real problem.
Oh, yeah. Today, the same. I mean, when you find yourself in a situation, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about another strong woman in the book, Julia. In the meantime, again, I'm holding up the cover. Randy just read from On the Fringes, A Clairvoyant, A Mining Swindle, and A Fresh Start. And we're going to hear a little bit about where you can find this book on the Out West Shop affiliate bookshop page. Don't go away. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guests. Special guest, Randy Samuelson Brown.
We're having a great time talking with you, Randy. There's just so much to talk about, right? We could talk for hours.
I know, it's fun.
So we were saying that there's some other strong women that show up in this book. And I would say as a reader, and I think you would agree as a reader, that this book has a lot of strong women and kind of not very, not men with a lot of morals or the women certainly kind of shine. Another one is Julia. You want to tell us a little bit about Julia?
Sure. So Julia was, there was actually a woman named Julia Robinson who ran a brothel in Cripple Creek. And Julia had probably about the second best parlor house. She was a businesswoman. Mm-hmm. She was also supporting a man who had a wife up in Denver. So this was kind of a frequent arrangement mm-hmm. with some of the madams that they had lots of money coming in. They kind of get these guys who didn't really mind living off of their earnings. And so Julia is really a businesswoman, and she thinks her paramour is up to something, and he is. Maude ends up meeting her through one of the dollies she meets on the street when some other woman is having a meltdown. And Julia, because she is able to find a ring that Julia lost, Julia believes that Maude's the real thing, says you can come back into the brothel and tell fortunes, you know, for entertainment. So this gives Maude some money outside of prostitution. But, you know, it's, once again, your surroundings aren't great. I mean, this would be where your mother told you not to go. And, you know, and here she is in a brothel telling fortunes. And I think, you know, the thing with Maude is she doesn't give sham fortunes. And so it's very hard for her telling fortunes in a brothel because there's a lot of things that aren't going to be good. And so, you know, she's kind of torn about what do I say? You know, she does try to give people good advice no matter who they are. And I do like that about Maude. So
Some of the things that I enjoyed as a reader were your descriptions of what life is like in a mining town, even meaning the sounds of a mining town. You know, when we visit, when we visit historic places or museum exhibits, it's kind of sanitized. You don't really get the smells. You don't get the sound of the stamp mills that are just the noise, the high noise level. Would you just talk a little bit about a mining town and sort of what one would expect?
You know, so you bring up a really good point, because today when we go visit these places, it is silent. You know, a lot of these places are ghost towns, or they're towns that, you know, aren't very well populated. So to take, for example, Idaho Springs, west of here, about 20 miles, that used to be a mill town, and it had the Argo Mill, and it was a huge stamp mill. And when a man would go take a job there, the docent said actually he was totally deaf inside of 3 days. And that's all the people that took jobs there. And so, you know, with a constant pounding, the windows in the houses would rattle. There'd be other trains coming through, bringing ore carts down. There'd be clattering rocks coming down. It would just be a nonstop racket. And I was up in Central City, and I was talking to a waitress in one restaurant. And, you know, it was interesting because I'm like, well, we were just there for like one of these haunted tours. And I'm like, you know, I always felt like this area is kind of haunted. And she's like, oh, yeah, I live up in Nevadaville, and I rent this house, and you can hear, like, the stamp mills in the middle of the night.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if that's true, but what she's hearing is not like the chains and rattling stuff, but she's hearing like thrumming of stamp mills. And I'm like, that's really interesting because, you know, she didn't study history, would she know that? You know, so I'm just kind of like, that was kind of an interesting conversation, but it would be loud. You know, boys used to blow up outhouses. So on top of everything else, there was dynamite, you know. That's a strange thing about Colorado that I was talking about with some friends from Texas. You know, they do their own thing and it's like, we blow things up. And I was up in Leadville and I was staying at this old hotel and looking back, there's like this bar. And I'm like, what happened to the back end of the bar? Well, Leadville still has active mines and some guy got dynamite and he blew up the back of the bar. Why? Nobody knows, but that's what they've been doing for like the last 125 years. I mean, they blow stuff up. So,
oh my gosh. Oh my goodness. We do have, we have a couple other shady guys besides Charlie, the husband who shows up again, but he we have an undertaker. I thought this storyline was quite interesting. There's an undertaker. Mr. Blake. And he kind of has a way to try to get some money out of Julia, which I thought was very interesting. You want to just touch on, was that something that went on regularly?
No, I actually don't think so. But the high idea of what was it like living in a mining camp, everybody would try to skim money off the top wherever they could. And I was also reading a lot or trying to read a lot about, we've always heard that there were like epidemics that would go through the mining camps. I've heard that so many times, you cannot find it in newspapers, so I do not know for a fact that these epidemics, I mean, diphtheria and little kids, and it's sad, but you know, but brothels were inspected for health and cleanliness. So if somebody died, if an undertaker or a mortician was not scrupulous, they could blackmail you and say, you know, I'm going to say your house is, you know, it needs to be quarantined. There were quarantines that were put out in Cripple Creek that I did find, which is where I got the idea on a newspaper. You know, so if everybody in the family had diphtheria or if everybody had scarlet fever, they would put, a Q. I think a sign with just the letter Q on the door for quarantine. So it's really the skimming and how do you get money and, you know, everybody would like just try to tip the scales, as it were, in their favor.
I know you have some questions.
You'll say the scales weren't always totally accurate.
The scales.
Yeah, those assayers would make, that's one of the characters, Sam, you know, we think Sam the assayer is, you know, a pretty good guy, and we found out maybe he's not such a good guy.
Well, so the assayer, which is another interesting thing. We still have assay offices from that period of time in some of the old towns. And you can talk to the guys who like own them or run them or all of that. And I was talking to people and mostly, as we talked about, assays would come back inflated. Normally, because somebody had a mine that wasn't really going to pay that well. So the owner of the mine would like probably try to get the assayer to say the results were higher and they'd give them $500 or whatever to do this. Well, you know, they've come up with a different angle that I talked to some of these old assayers and they thought that was hysterical. They're like, I never thought of that. You know, and I'm like, so what's really funny is it kind of teaches you that even if people have seen a lot in their lives and they've thought of all the possibilities, there's always one wackadoodle that comes up with some other idea that they just, you know, it's just so counterintuitive that they kind of discount it. And then it's like, whoa. And if you, I think the element of surprise and pulling off a swindle is always a good thing.
That's probably true. These characters, did they surprise you as you were writing?
Did they surprise me as I was writing? Well, Sam started off as like a good guy, like you said. I mean, I think he liked Maude. I think, you know, I think he was poor too, though. So like there's all this gold flowing around and the very few people got very wealthy. And the people who work regular jobs were not so wealthy. So I think that was an issue. You know, did they surprise me? Julia's boyfriend surprised me at how kind of rotten he could be. I guess that was a surprise, you know, because he started out rotten. Everett. And I thought he was going to do something else, but that's not what happened. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting with Everett, the gentleman you're just talking about, because Julia, obviously, you know, she's got a thing for him. And we see him through Julia's eyes, and then we see him through some other women's eyes, and we kind of go like, what is Julia seeing in this guy?
You know,
love is blind.
Love is very blind. And, you know, these women, they would really support men that most people would not want. I think they tended to be flashy. I think they kind of treated them like a lady, maybe just not 100% great, but more than just a standard upstanding guy would. And I think the women fell for this. I mean, I honestly do. So, you know, yeah, Everett's not that great of a guy, drank too much. You know, he hangs around drinking. She gives him $50 to go gambling just to get him out of her parlor, you know, and it's like, oh my God.
We're going to take another short break. And Randy, when we come back, let's switch and talk a little bit about research and a little bit about writing process. And maybe a tip for writers. And stay tuned. Stay with us. Here is a word from our sponsor, OutWestShop.com.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with Randy Samuelson Brown.
Yes, and we're talking about her book, On the Fringes, A Clairvoyant, A Mining Swindle, and A Fresh Start. And of course, one of the other books that she has available, she actually has written a number of books, and they're all on our Out West Shop bookshop page, but Brand Chaser as well. And do you want to ask her a little bit about...
You mean about what sort of research did you do on clairvoyance? And
well, she has tarot. Did you have to learn how to read tarot cards in order to write about those cards as they pop up?
Nope. You know, I Googled it on the internet and I did fortune telling with regular playing cards. And there are people out there who've gone like through and it's like, The two of spades means this, you know, and it goes on and on with all the what the cards mean. And when I get stuck with the story, seriously, I would like draw out like six cards, lay them out, and what do I think that tells me? And all of a sudden, the story's going in a different direction, and I just kind of went with it to have fun.
Yeah, you know? That's a new solution to writer's block. I have to remember that, you know.
It is, seriously. I mean, you could do that with anything. And the first time I tried that was actually a sequence in between Maude and Rose when she was reading fortunes. And it said, you know, an alliance, a treacherous alliance or something of that nature. And that's exactly what she got. And that's what the card said. So, I mean, I was just kind of laughing. And, so if I ever got stuck, I took out my cheat sheet and got out some cards and see what they wanted to tell me. So...
Well, we're exactly, I think, schools with this kind of thing. Is this a handed down from person to person education on how to?
Oh, well,
like,
I
what's the two of clubs worth? I mean, what does that mean? And, you know,
what's the ace of hearts mean? I mean, it could be somebody just out there making things up, and then I come bumbling along, and I'm like, the two of spades means this, you know? Anything's possible.
So far you haven't had any readers that have said to you, that's not what the two of spades means. You haven't had any.
No, and if they do, I will just have to say, you know, I got this off the internet. But, you know, it's interesting because in my life, I did know one lady who used to tell fortunes with regular playing cards. And she used to occasionally help the police try to find missing people and up in the mountains. And I don't think she ever located any, so I don't know if she was considered a crackpot or if she was considered of assistance. And then I also know another family that did have, like, people who could read palms. And, you know, during the Depression, they were also related to the Red Light District. And during the Depression, they needed food. They had a large family, lots of kids, you know, and a policeman came to the house, wanted his fortune read. You know, he lined the woman's palm with silver, and she's looking at it, and you know, she's like, oh gosh, I don't know what's wrong with me, I just can't read your fortune, I have to give you your money back, I just can't do it tonight for whatever. And the man leaves, and like the kids are like, why didn't you just make something up, you know? And she's like, well, I won't take money from a dead man. And that man actually died that night on the beach. So, wow. I mean, some people do have the ability, I do believe, to read fortunes or palms or see what the cards say. I mean, it may not be apparent to me, but.
you mentioned when we were chatting with you that when you sat down kind of to write, you put a question, you put a promise out to the universe, which I thought was a great tip for a new writer. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. My first book was called The Beaten Territory, which became Market Street Madam with a different publisher. And I kind of put it out to the universe, if somehow, some way this book got published, you know, that was like my big goal. That was like the big goal. And in return, that I would support any local museum, local library, historical society that wanted me to talk or needed some sort of support. And that idea, and I don't even know why I came up with that thought of making a bargain with what it was. You know, Colorado and other Western states have supported me very, very nicely, and I do try to support them back. And whatever that bargain was has definitely been a win-win for me. And I think it really helps sometimes some of the smaller towns, especially where the populations are dwindling or the people are getting older. And, you know, it's nice to have people come in and talk about things that they're interested in, but I also like to listen to their stories. And so when they tell me, you know, about like in the 30s when they're trudging through, you know, the 5-foot drifts of snow and all that, they may not even be exaggerating, or they may, but the stories are fabulous. And a lot of stuff that they tell me, I may not use that story directly, but it can flavor what I end up writing. So I just think that's, for me, that's a very good way to go through the whole process.
And you were somewhere today, weren't you?
I was at the Eugene Fields Library in Denver, and we had a crowd of about, oh, I don't know if I'd call it a big crowd, there was about 10 senior citizens that came, and it was actually a very fun time, and they were very interested. We talked about notable or notorious Colorado women, and they were just laughing because these women are all just like, they're just off the charts in their own way. And it's just like, they're like, we never learned about these people in school. And I'm like, well, no, because, you know, when we, you know, they used to teach Colorado history in fifth grade, you know, and it was kind of more like, they wanted us to be proud, you know, and it's like, these people built schools and they curbed, you know, their businesses out of the wilderness and stuff. But, you know, I've always been more drawn to like the more obscure type of people, the crackpots,
the shady characters.
I know you have questions.
You know, speaking of your publisher, how did you get connected with Wolfpack?
Wolfpack, I met at the Women Writing the West Conference in San Antonio a couple of years ago. And that's a group of women writers, all different levels. There's some of us who are published. I wasn't, you know, I started off unpublished like everybody else. That's where you start. That's just how it goes. And I met Mike Bray, who was the head of Wolfpack, and he was really nice. And I sat there and talked to him for a while, and he's like, well, do you have anything right now? And I'm like, well, I have this World War I book, which is not what Wolfpack does at all. And he's like, well, if you send it to me, I'll take a look at it. So, you know, I went up to my room and I sent it to him. And I think he was astounded that actually I did exactly what I said I was going to do when I said I was going to do it. And he liked what he read. So he's like, well, I want to work with you. And a year passed and I had two other publishers and I was just working with them. And I was at Western Writers of America in Loveland, Colorado. And he's like, no, I really want to work with you. Will you write something for us? And so I figured, you know, it was a far cry in a very short time from when I'm like, please let me write for you. Please read this, please anything. And then people are now asking me to write for them. I'm like, wow. So, yes, I took him up on his offer, and that's where Brand Chaser came from.
Right, right. And I believe that they also, Wolfpack, or through Wolfpack, they have a fabulous author interview program, a podcast, Six Guns Justice.
I think that one's run by my acquiring editor, Paul Bishop. And they do a great job. I love some of the conversations, especially if I'm on a road trip driving someplace. You know, I just download podcasts and listen. Rendezvous with a Writer would be another great thing, you know, just to like listen to a bunch of different people. And, you know, it's kind of fun because you get inspired by other people's stories or ideas or, you know, it's all good. It's a great art form.
Yeah. Tell us about your writing schedule, if you have such a thing.
Well, I do, especially when I have a deadline. So I start getting really focused really fast. Normally I write between about 8 and 10 at night, especially if I'm just kind of doing what I want to do. Now that I have a deadline, I'm writing every weekend. I'm trying to write hopefully like 5,000 words a weekend, which is a fairly large amount of words, you know. So it's really about 250 words per page is how I go. So, I mean, it's a chunk of writing. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, like, you talk to people in writers' conferences and a lot of people plot out everything. It turns out, you know, like this is going to happen and this is going to happen and this is going to happen. I cannot do that to save my soul because my characters tend to take over. And so I might think they're going to do something and they do something else and I just have to follow them. So sometimes I get kind of scared towards the end because I'm like, I don't know how this is all going to end up. But so far, it's all managed to like do okay. So it's like they haven't let me down, but it's kind of like, ooh.
It has to be exciting to be a writer and that you're on that kind of adventure that you have an idea and then you're just trying to keep up with it.
Well, it is because it gives you a chance to see so many different lifestyles or so many different circumstances, and you aren't like actually physically experiencing them. Like I'm not like shivering in Cripple Creek going, I don't have any food, you know, I'm like, I'm fine. I got a refrigerator full, you know, and, but it's just very interesting. And I think it makes you a little bit more empathetic towards humanity as a whole, because when you're kind of writing different characters and they have their own backstories and there's reasons even why kind of jerky people are the way they are. I mean, when you're writing about it, you really do have to understand them. So I think in real life, when somebody isn't behaving exactly what I think would be pleasant or nice, I mean, I think I give them a little bit more benefit of the doubt just due to writing.
Well, I wondered, as we were just starting to read the book, about a prequel for how Maude and Charlie, you know, what was their story before we meet them at the beginning of this book?
Yeah.
And then, of course, I'm hoping that we could see Maude, you know, in another story after this one, because we really like her and she's an interesting character with an interesting, you know, talent. So what do you think about that?
I like that idea. I mean, at first people, I used to have a friend who would read my work, and she and I were like writing buddies, and she's like, I can see this in a series. And I'm like, no, it's only the one. But actually, I could see her going into Denver, and, you know, Denver's a wild, wicked place, you know, but I think she's really a good person. But, you know, she could help the police. She could help. You know, a lot was going on in Denver. She could just kind of pick her poison and decide what she wanted to do, you know. So.
Yeah. So, Randy, how can people find you, follow you, and what's up next?
Okay, well, my website is www.randysamuelsonbrown.com, all one word. You can find me there. That's probably the best place. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and a little bit on Instagram. What's next right now is the third installment of the Dark Range series. And this one is going to take place up in northwestern Colorado in the Craig area, which I'm calling Vermilion because I don't want to step on anybody's toes. And I was talking to the BLM up there today, asking them about the wild horses and like a lot of the stuff that goes on with that, and the reintroduction of the wolves in Wyoming coming down and all of that type of thing. So, I mean, that is one benefit of being a writer, too. It kind of opens doors to things you wouldn't normally see, and people tolerate the weirdest questions. You know, I'm like, I wonder what these people think when they pick up the phone. They're like, oh, good Lord, you know. And I'm like, I made a new friend today. And so when I am up in Craig to see the wild horses, when the snow kind of subsides a little bit, I'm bringing that man a book. And he told me exactly like where the office is. So, you know, it's all good. It's really a joy to meet so many nice people.
Well, we thank you for being with us. Don't go away, but we are going to kind of wrap the show. We thank you so much for being with us. And we were talking again, don't forget, about Brand Chaser and the book that follows it that's out now, and a third book on the way. And the one that we focused on tonight, On the Fringes, A Clairvoyant, A Mining Swindle, and A Fresh Start by Randy Samuelson Brown. And next week, all right, I'm going to my book cache over here. Next week, author Mary Camarillo will join us with her book, The Lockhart Women. And we'll start reading this tomorrow for sure. And Jim, do you have a quote for this week?
Oh, I do. We do have a quote. We actually have two quotes. One is from Maud, our key character. It's from her mom. And I guess before she took her trip. If you lie down with dogs, you'll get up with fleas.
It's so true.
And we have one other. This is from the actor James Caan. I went to a shrink once, but I caught him going to a fortune teller. So I quit.
And you had one more.
Oh.
You have one more.
I didn't know we have time.
This is
from one of our other characters, the fortune teller Rose. And this is a proverb from the School of Hard Knocks. If you fly with the crows, you'll get shot with the crows.
Good thoughts to remember.
Yeah, not all the different... bit different from her mom, what her mom had to say to her from the start.
Exactly. Well, we're so delighted you were with us tonight. Thank you to Randy Samuelson Brown and to Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band, who will close us up in a moment. Thank you to Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio. And we'll see you same time
next week.
And remember,
it's always a great day.
Out West. Have a great week.
listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.